Theology Explained. Episode 1. What is an idea? Hello, and welcome to the very first episode of Ideology Explained, a series that will seek to provide definitions of, background to, and greater familiarity with some of the most common ideas, concepts, and abstract terminology we use in everyday conversation. A preface to the series. Given that this is the first episode in the series, I thought it would be fitting to begin with an explanation of what motivated me to start the series, and what I hope listeners will get out of it. Like many of you, I'm certain, I have become increasingly aware, and consequently concerned, by how often these days we are unable to reconcile our differences and resolve our disagreements because of a basic inability, or perhaps unwillingness, to understand the perspective from which other people are approaching a given topic. In practical terms, what this frequently means is that we use certain complex ideas and concepts freely in conversation without due regard or consideration for whether other people understand these ideas in the same way as we do, or indeed whether we ourselves fully apprehend the depth and diversity of thought associated with these ideas. The ideas I'm referring to are not obscure or esoteric, meant to be understood only by a select few in certain fields of study, but so commonplace and so often repeated that there is a broad, unspoken presumption that we must all be reciprocally familiar with what these ideas mean, not just in outline, but in precise detail. Ideas such as liberty, equality, freedom, and fairness are so almost trivially familiar terms to us today that it is worryingly unclear just how much thought is given to them when they are evoked in conversation, or indeed whether any reflection is given to the notion that others may understand those ideas differently to ourselves. I hope that you can appreciate why all of this concerns me as much as it does. Fundamentally, our ability to communicate in a meaningful and coherent way is predicated on the assumption that our use of words evokes in the minds of others the same, or at the very least, substantively similar thoughts that pervade our own and that we mean to convey. A failure to grapple with and grasp the richness of an idea will not merely render us unable to reconcile difference or resolve disagreement, but I fear it will so solidly entrench our differences and disagreements into the fabric of society that division and hostility will perpetuate and abound. Now, contrary to what you may be thinking, I am not launching the Ideology Explained series under the romantic delusion that by it I will somehow single-handedly remedy or rectify the faults in our discourse. Rather, this project amounts to no more or less than what a single person can hope to achieve on their own, an attempt to make our discourse better. Moving forward, I hope to offer you dispassionate appraisals of various ideas and concepts that have fascinated and confounded humanity, some of them for centuries. Through the episodes of this series, I hope you will gain greater insight into the ideas examined, and that this insight will assist you in conversing with those that may disagree with you, or perhaps even give you an appreciation for the nature of that disagreement, such that, if nothing else, you can respect its existence. Thank you for choosing to listen, and I sincerely hope that you continue to do so. For this first episode, I could think of no more appropriate topic to consider than the abstract notion that lends its connotation to the title of the series, What is an Idea? What do we mean when we say that we have an idea? Similarly, what is it to have an idea of something? These are just some of the questions we are going to explore in today's episode, examining schools of thought within a variety of philosophical traditions, including those that are less well studied within the English-speaking world. Part 1. The Theory of Ideas. We shall begin with the most systematic exposition and analysis of the nature of ideas available to us, the theory of ideas developed within the Western philosophical tradition. Some of the earliest reflections on what is meant by an idea can be traced, as is so often the case, to ancient Greece. Indeed, our English word idea, which was adopted from Latin, has its roots in the ancient Greek word idea, which refers to the form, shape, look, or appearance of something. If these aspects of something sound similar to those qualities of it that can be perceived with one's eyes, it should be noted that the term idea is derived from the verb idien, which means to see. It could be inferred from this, therefore, that the ancient Greek understanding of an idea was intimately connected to visual, more broadly, sensory perception, and how things appear to human beings when we perceive them with our senses. However, for the first theorist we are going to examine in this episode, the ancient Greek philosopher Plato, there was an important distinction to be made between an apprehension of the material world by way of perception and the comprehension of the non-material world by way of reason. According to Plato, the material world is not the true reality. Instead, there exists a higher, non-material realm that contains non-physical, perfect, unchanging, eternal ideas, or forms, as it is sometimes translated. The material world is a mere imperfect copy or reflection of these forms. Therefore, sensory perception cannot comprehend the forms. Rather, intellect and reason are needed to grasp them. In this way, the term idea for Plato is used to contrast with the verb idien, because whilst you may see the imperfect, fleeting impressions of entities in the material world, this does not mean you have comprehended their essential nature, given that the latter are objects of the intellect alone. This distinction between sensory perception facilitating an apprehension of the material world and the intellect facilitating a comprehension of non-material objects of knowledge has moved our exploration of the question of what an idea is a few paces forward. We can now conceive of an idea as either a product of sensory perception, or object of the senses, if you will, or else we can cognize it as a product of thought and reason, or, for want of a better phrase, an object of the understanding. A theorist who embraced this way of characterizing ideas was another philosopher from ancient Greece, Aristotle, who, whilst rejecting his teacher Plato's evocation of a non-material realm of forms, did argue that objects of the understanding can be derived, or abstracted, from sensory experience of the material world. In contrast to Plato's separation of forms from the material world, Aristotle argues that the form, or eidos, of an object is inseparable from the object itself. Accordingly, the essence of a thing is intrinsic to it, not something that exists independently of it in another realm. This means that the form, idea, of an object is found in the object itself within the material world as a characteristic of something material. For Aristotle, a substance is the combination of form and matter. This substance is the real, fundamental reality that we can perceive and understand. The essence of an object is its defining characteristics, the form that makes it what it is. Every substance has an essence that is realized in the physical world through the combination of form and matter. Sensory experience then leads to abstraction and understanding of the forms inherent in the objects we perceive. Comparing the contributions of Plato and Aristotle to the theory of ideas side by side, we have now been introduced to two contrasting schools of thought in the Western philosophical tradition on the topic. These are idealism, as exemplified by Plato's theory of forms, and realism, as exemplified by Aristotle's counterposition. Whilst the precise systems of thought that compose these contrasting viewpoints have diversified and specialized greatly in the centuries since the works of Plato and Aristotle, the foundations laid by them and their influence still is clearly detectable today. For the purposes of this episode of Ideology Explained, it will not be necessary to examine the schools of idealism and realism in any greater detail than to make note of them in their most extreme manner of expression as the two archetypal polar perspectives providing an answer to our central question, what is an idea? On the one hand, according to the idealist, ideas are wholly and exclusively objects of the mind, whereas, on the other hand, according to the realist, ideas come from the external world as products of experience by means of sensory perception. Those listeners with slightly more than a casual familiarity with philosophy will no doubt have observed that this characterization of idealism and realism greatly simplifies and condenses various separate areas of philosophical inquiry. I have, for instance, purposely avoided using technical philosophical terminology such as ontology and epistemology so that the narrative can be as accessible to as broad a range of listeners as possible. For those who do have a greater interest in the subject matter, I can clarify that the extreme expressions of idealism and realism I described earlier refer to these schools of thought in both the ontological and epistemic sense. However, I will not, in this episode at least, expand on the interplay between metaphysics and epistemology as it pertains to the theory of ideas, given the risk of weighing down the narrative of this episode. In order for this series to achieve its stated purpose, our exploration of the ideas and concepts central to each episode must be presented in a way that lends itself to be understood as much by listeners with no prior knowledge of these ideas as it does by listeners with training in philosophy. Having acquired a basic grounding in how the question of what an idea is has been analyzed in the Western philosophical tradition, we shall examine the contribution of some representative theorists whose work has advanced and greatly influenced opinion with regard to the theory of ideas. Part 2. Representative theories in the Western philosophical tradition. We shall begin with the work of the British philosopher John Locke, whose theory of ideas shares many similarities to that of Aristotle. Locke's basic proposition is that all human knowledge stems from sensory experience and subsequent reflection. In his view, human beings are born with minds empty of all ideas, or a tabula rasa, a blank slate, as he refers to it. Thereafter, the mind is populated with ideas by means of experience, which he argues can be categorized into two mechanisms of experience: sensation, the process of receiving information about the external world by way of our senses, and reflection, the process of gaining knowledge about our own mental operations through the application of thought. Whilst Locke accepts that some ideas are not the direct products of sensory perception, his thesis is that interaction with the external world necessarily precedes introspection, thus the only source of ideas is experience. A distinguishing feature of Locke's theory of ideas is the identification of two separate qualities attributable to external objects, which, therefore, differentiates the type of idea that experience can give rise to within the human mind. Locke refers to as primary qualities those properties of an object that are an inherent part of the existence of that object, such that these qualities are perceived in the same way by all observers. The shape, size, or number of objects are examples of such primary qualities whose manifestation does not depend on the sensory apparatus of an observer. In contrast, Locke refers to as secondary qualities those properties of objects that arise as a consequence of the interaction between an object and an observer. These qualities do not exist in the object itself, but rather depend for their existence on the sensory apparatus of an observer. For instance, color, sound, and smell. As such, it is entirely feasible, in Locke's view, that the idea generated by a secondary quality can vary between minds, to the extent that one person's idea of a secondary quality can be entirely different to the idea of someone else. Locke's contribution to the Western philosophical tradition introduces the intriguing notion that there is a class of idea that are personal to an individual, and whilst we can evoke in another's mind their version of that idea, we cannot be certain that the idea harbored by another person is precisely the same as the idea that exists in our own mind. Moreover, since our ideas come from sensory experience, Locke believes that knowledge is limited by the scope and reliability of that experience. Our access to reality and the formulation of our ideas is limited by our sensory capabilities and the constitution of our experiences. A dramatically different account of how the human mind relates to the world and what is meant by an idea can be found in the work of the German idealist philosopher George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. In Hegel's system, ideas are not separate from reality in the way Locke suggests that they are, secondary qualities that are not an inherent part of objects of experience, nor are they static or pre-existing forms in the way Plato thought of them. Instead, Hegel positions ideas as the very essence of reality, part of the process by which reality itself develops. According to Hegel, ideas are not merely mental representations or static entities. They are the driving force of reality, because, for Hegel, the totality of existence is essentially mental or spiritual. The world, or ultimate reality, is the manifestation of a rational, evolving process of thought or spirit, Geist in the German, which unfolds through history. This dynamic unfolding process involves a logical progression of contradictions and their resolutions, a movement that explains the development of thought, history, and because thought and reality are interconnected in Hegel's system, even the structure of reality itself. This process, referred to by him as the dialectic, not only accounts for how ideas arise or are affirmed, but also how they evolve and develop over time. Hegel's system is complex, and the role of ideas in his work serve a grander function than what we are interested in exploring for the purposes of this episode. However, the aspect of his system that may be worthwhile exploring, since it introduces a new perspective to our ongoing understanding of an idea, is how the self-generating and iterative process at the heart of his system, the dialectic, propels the development of new ideas. Hegel's dialectic consists of three stages. First, the affirmation of an initial starting point, which could be a condition or state of affairs. Second, the negation or contradiction of that initial starting point, which represents opposition to it or conflict with it, a force that challenges or disrupts the original state. Finally, the resolution of the contradiction, which allows a reconciliation of the first two stages, and, by incorporating elements of both, transcends them to realize a higher, more developed form of the idea. These three stages then repeat, in a spiraling fashion, as the resolution to one contradiction gives rise to a new affirmation, which, in itself, contains limitations that generate new, opposing ideas, new contradictions in need of resolution. In this way, contradiction is the central driving force of progress and the development of ideas in Hegel's system. New ideas emerge from, lead to, and form the basis for the resolution of contradiction. This notion, that ideas contain within themselves their own negation, is a profound observation and addition to the theory of ideas. Whilst Aristotle and Locke did accept that abstraction and reflection do give rise to new, more complex ideas, Hegel describes ideas as being in a continual process of development, transformation, and evolution, driven by the unfolding of contradictions and their resolutions. Ideas undergo a kind of self-development by which they become more realized versions of themselves over time. Attempting to reconcile the acceptance of the limitations of human knowledge that theorists such as Locke were forced to admit to, and the seeming rational purity and absolute knowledge offered by idealists such as Hegel, the German Enlightenment philosopher Immanuel Kant developed a theory that had profound implications for our understanding of human knowledge and perception. However, before proceeding to consider Kant's theory, listeners must be advised of an issue relating to terminology. The term idea, as Kant uses it in his work, has a technical meaning that differs greatly from the sense in which all other theorists we have considered so far have used it. Kant uses the term concept to refer to ideas as we have come to understand the term over the course of this episode, whereas ideas in Kant's theory are a special subset of concepts that relate to the conditions for the possibility of the highest forms of human cognition. This will be better understood as we turn to examining Kant's theory. However, for the sake of consistency and in aid of assisting the listener form a coherent answer to the central question of this episode, what is an idea, use of the term idea in the forthcoming narrative will not refer to the technical sense in which Kant uses it, but rather the sense in which we have by now become familiar. A starting point to understanding Kant's theory of ideas is by differentiating between the world as it appears to us, which we access and come to know by way of sensory perception, and things as they are in themselves, which refers to how the world exists independently of our perception of it. We should be familiar enough with this distinction by this point in the episode, even if the two schools of thought we have examined up to this point deny that ideas arise via one or other of these characterizations of the world. Realists would argue that our ideas relate directly to the world, such that things as they appear to us, and things in themselves, are one and the same. Idealists would deny that things as they appear to us are capable of providing true knowledge, that since ideas are objects of the understanding, it is the thing in itself that exists in the human mind. Kant, however, not only accepts the existence of both things in themselves and things as they appear to us, he further argues that the scope of human knowledge is limited to things as they appear to us, such that we can never have direct knowledge of the true nature of things as they are in themselves. Kant's reasons for coming to this conclusion relate to the role of the human mind in his theory of ideas. For Kant, the mind is not merely the passive receiver of sense data from the external world in the way that a realist may think of it, nor is it the sole source or emitter of all ideas constitutive of human experience, as an idealist may contend. Rather, the mind possesses certain innate cognitive faculties that actively structure human experience and thereby amount to the conditions for the possibility of experience itself. Since these innate faculties mediate human experience, which is to say they filter the raw sensory data we receive by way of perception, making it intelligible, things in themselves cannot be known directly since our cognitive faculties lack the sense data required in order to make them intelligible. In this way, Kant propounds two separate species of idea, in the sense we've come to understand this term. There are those ideas that are derived from experience, as a consequence of human perception receiving sensory data from the external world. And there are those ideas that are inherent in the human mind, which not only categorize and structure human cognition, but they are the necessary conditions for the possibility of the first species of idea being intelligible to human beings at all. As examples of this second species of idea, conditions for the possibility of experience, Kant cites such things as causality, substance, unity, and necessity. For instance, the innate idea of causality is a necessary condition for our ability to perceive events in the world as having causes and effects, and to understand the unfolding of events over time. Kant's contribution to the theory of ideas was remarkable, even revolutionary. The notion that there are innate ideas that human beings must already have as part of what constitutes human cognition in order to interpret and organize the sensory data we receive through experience has significant implications for the relationship between the human mind and the external world. Whilst the active role of the mind in developing ideas would be a proposition shared by an idealist, Kant's innovation was to suggest that ideas are either a consequence of the mind actively shaping experience, or else they relate to the conditions for the possibility of this activity being able to take place. Part 3. The Theory of Ideas in Middle Eastern Philosophy. It will not have escaped the regard of some listeners that our foregoing exploration of the theory of ideas in Western philosophy was conducted from a largely secular perspective. This choice was made not to undermine or ignore the influence of theological contribution to Western philosophical thought, but rather because scholarly reflections on what is meant by the abstract notion of an idea, which is the subject matter of this episode, proceeded from a largely secular point of view. Philosophical schools of thought that attempted to reconcile theological scholarship with this secular advancement in the theory of ideas were more concerned with understanding certain specific ideas, which are fundamental to their theology, rather than proposing discrete answers to the question, what is an idea? For this reason, the work of Christian theologians such as Augustine of Hippo or Thomas Aquinas would be better placed in future episodes of this series in relation to the specific ideas they were interested in, rather than in relation to our current exploration of what is meant by an idea more generally. Whilst a fairly clean separation between secular and theological analyses of ideas, and in particular that of an idea in the abstract, is feasible from a Western philosophical perspective, this is far less easy to achieve when we turn our attention to non-Western philosophical traditions. As we will come to see, the theory of ideas outside of Western philosophy is deeply rooted in and fundamentally inseparable from theological accounts of human experience. Having said this, a good intermediary set of traditions that provide a bridge between the largely secular Western philosophical theory of ideas and those more infused with theological systems of thought are the philosophical traditions that developed in the Middle East, which attempted to combine the ancient Greek contribution to the theory of ideas, particularly the work of Plato and Aristotle, with theological scholarship in Judaism and Islam. Although Jewish theology predates the work of Plato and Aristotle, scholarship in relation to the abstract notion of an idea was not as predominant a feature of it until Greek influence spread across the region following the conquests of Alexander the Great. A particularly influential figure, whose work represents a significant contribution to the theory of ideas in Jewish theology, was the Egyptian philosopher Philo of Alexandria. Philo's theory of ideas attempted to adapt Plato's account of ideas forms with Jewish theological accounts of the divine and the creation of the cosmos. Unlike Plato's ideas, or forms, which exist independently of the material world and are the true reality. For Philo, ideas are intimately connected to the divine intellect and are seen as manifestations of divine reason. For Philo, ideas are not mere abstractions, they are emanations from God and represent the ultimate source of all reality. In Philo's system, this divine intellect, or mind, is the same as God, the source of all reality, and is itself in constant thought and reflection. In this context, ideas are divine thoughts, and, far from being arbitrary, represent divine order. According to Philo's theory of ideas, an idea is not external to God, but is, in a sense, internal to God's intellect. In this model, the divine mind reflects upon itself, giving rise to ideas, which are the perfect models for the created world. The relationship between God and ideas is thus one of unity and causality. God, as the supreme intellect, is the cause and source of all ideas, and ideas, in turn, serve as paradigms for the creation of the physical world. In this way, the created world mirrors the external, unchanging nature of ideas in the divine mind. The material world, while imperfect and subject to change, is still a reflection of the divine order expressed through these ideas. The influence of the theory of ideas as developed by Plato and Aristotle can also be seen in early Islamic theology. Whereas Philo was principally engaged in reconciling Plato's work with the theological tradition to which he adhered, early Islamic theologians were as interested in synthesizing Plato and Aristotle's contrasting perspectives with one another as much as integrating this combined theory of ideas with Islamic theological thought. An especially prominent figure to examine in this regard was the Muslim philosopher Abu Nasr al-Farabi. A later Muslim theologian who was far more exercised by defending Aristotle's theory of ideas and integrating it with Islamic teaching than salvaging any element of Plato's contribution was the Andalusian philosopher Ahmed ibn Rushd, also known as Abi Ruiz. Al-Farabi's theory of ideas adopts Aristotle's description of everything in the material world as being composed of form and matter, and attempts to merge this with Plato's characterization of ideas as perfect forms. He subsequently situates this synthesized theory of ideas within a theologically inspired process of emanation, in which God is the necessary being, or the first cause, and everything else emanates from God in a structured order. For Al-Farabi, the process of emanation begins with God, who is defined as pure existence and intellect. God's intellect produces the first intellect, which in turn emanates further intellects and souls, culminating in the material world. In this context, ideas are divine intellectual realities that emanate from the divine mind and provide the blueprint for the created world. Human beings then access knowledge of the external world through a process of intellectual abstraction in a fashion similar to that proposed by Aristotle. Al-Farabi too emphasizes the role of the active intellect in this process, contrasting it to the potential intellect, which is the part of the soul that has the capacity for knowledge but is not yet actualized. The active intellect, however, is the external and divine intellect that is responsible for abstracting universal forms from particular sensory experiences and actualizing the potential intellect. The active intellect plays a pivotal role in Al-Farabi's theory of ideas. According to Al-Farabi, knowledge begins with sense perception of the material world. The senses provide information about individual particular objects, but the mind is capable of abstracting the universals, the essential forms, from these particulars through the intervention of the active intellect. This allows the human mind to grasp universal truths about the world, which are connected to the eternal, divine ideas. Where Al-Farabi's theory of ideas shares similarities to that of Plato is in his assertion that the soul has access to the world of ideas through recollection and intellectual abstraction. However, Al-Farabi places much more emphasis on the active intellect as the intermediary between the human mind and the divine realm of ideas. Where Al-Farabi's theory more resembles Aristotle is in his description of the relationship between the potential intellect and the active intellect, with the potential intellect being responsible for the receipt of sensory data from the external world, and thereafter the active intellect being responsible for the abstraction of universal ideas from this sensory data. Shifting away from this separation of the material world from a divine realm, and very much in direct opposition to Plato's view of there being a separate non-material realm of perfect ideas, the theory of ideas developed by Abi Ruiz remained steadfastly faithful to Aristotle's contribution to the subject matter. According to Averroes, reality is composed of substances and accidents, substances being the fundamental underlying reality that exists in its own right, while accidents are properties that adhere to substances but do not exist independently of them. From this position, Averroes argues that knowledge of the world must begin with particulars, which are individual, concrete objects that exist in the material world. The material world is the primary reality, and the ideas we abstract from it are the secondary realities. While Averroes acknowledges the existence of abstract or non-material ideas, in his view, these ideas exist within the individual objects and are abstracted from them by the human intellect. Universal ideas are thus inseparable from the material world, though they are not identical to individual instances. Although Averroes, much like Al-Farabi, did engage in a project of integrating his theory of ideas with his theological beliefs, unlike earlier Muslim theologians who posited that ideas were a direct emanation from the divine, Averroes follows Aristotle's framework to argue that God's intellect is the source of all intelligibility in the universe. Whilst ideas in this system do have a divine origin, they do not emanate directly from God. Rather, the divine intellect is held to have perfect knowledge of all things, and these ideas are reflected in the material world as individual objects, which are subsequently accessed by the human intellect through abstraction. Once again, abstraction and the active intellect are central to Averroes' theory of ideas, but in his system, much as in that of Aristotle, the universal ideas that are generated by the active intellect through the process of abstraction are derived from the material world and ultimately have no separate existence other than as the generalized non-material representation of particular instances in the material world. In this way, the active intellect functions by illuminating the potential intellect, enabling it to abstract universal ideas from particular experiences of and in the material world.
Part 4.
The Theory of Ideas in Hinduism and Theravada Buddhism. As we turn to consider schools of thought more detached from the Western philosophical tradition, we must acknowledge the fact that a formal, systematic theory of ideas, which is to say, a specific account of what is meant by the term idea itself, is not as straightforwardly expressed as we have encountered it so far in this episode. Rather, we will need to infer what these schools of thought have to contribute to our ongoing exploration of the notion of an idea by analyzing key themes and principles within various philosophical and theological traditions that have emerged across the world. The first philosophical tradition we are going to examine, those fundamental to and emergent from Hindu spiritual thought, share many themes and ways of characterizing human experience that we have already encountered in earlier parts of this episode. Before proceeding, however, an advisory note of sorts is perhaps needed. The schools of thought we are about to consider have at least as much, if not more, breadth of scholarship and diversity of viewpoint associated with them as that associated with the Western philosophical tradition. At least for the purposes of this episode, I will not attempt to summarize the theory of ideas in the totality of each school of thought, but simply attempt to provide you with an outline of the type of response a thinker belonging to these traditions would give to our central question, what is an idea? Whilst Hindu philosophy itself comprises many different schools of thought, central to all of them is an exploration of the relationship between Atman, the nature of the self, and Brahman, the ultimate reality. Additionally, rather than being concerned about ideas in the abstract, which is to say, as no more than objects of the understanding, Hindu philosophy places emphasis on the experiential and transformative nature of ideas, often as tools for achieving higher consciousness and ultimate liberation. This, as an approach to the theory of ideas, does much to distinguish non-Western philosophical traditions to the Western one, and we shall see the practical implication of an idea become especially important in the next part of this episode. Central to the thoughts expressed in the ancient Hindu sacred texts known as the Vedas is Brahman, the ultimate and unchanging reality. Brahman is described as formless, infinite, and transcendent, yet it is the source of all creation, and knowledge of Brahman is the key to understanding the true nature of the self, Atman, and the universe. The approach to knowledge, based on some interpretations of the Vedas, involves direct mystical experience rather than abstract theorization. Self-reflection is viewed as the highest form of knowledge, where the individual realizes that the Atman, the individual soul, is one with Brahman. Ideas as a result are seen as stepping stones towards self-realization. Within the context of this distinction between Atman and Brahman, different schools of Hinduism provide contrasting accounts of how to characterize specific ideas in relation to each of these realities. The Sankhya school of Hindu philosophy proposes that the universe is composed of two fundamental realities, Purusha, the eternal, unchanging consciousness, and Prakriti, the material, changing nature of the world. According to Sankhya, ideas are manifestations of Prakriti, the material world, which includes both the mental and physical realms, arising from the interaction between the mind and the material world. The mind processes sensory inputs to form mental representations, or ideas, which can lead to ignorance about the true nature of reality, or more precisely, act as a barrier preventing the recognition of the true self, Purusha. The Advaita Vedanta school, on the other hand, teaches that the ultimate reality just is Brahman, and everything else, including the self, Atman, is an illusion. According to this tradition, the world of ideas, forms, and distinctions is not ultimately real, but is a projection of the mind. The human mind creates ideas that appear to distinguish between self and other, subject and object, but these distinctions are ultimately illusory. Ultimate knowledge in Advaita Vedanta is the realization that Atman, the individual soul, is identical with Brahman, the ultimate reality. This realization transcends all ideas, concepts, and distinctions because it is a direct, unmediated experience of unity. Ideas in this system may be functional and useful in the empirical world. They are, however, ultimately regarded as temporary and unreal. The goal of this tradition is to move beyond the illusory power of the mind, which projects diversity onto the underlying unity of Brahman, and to realize the self's inherent oneness with Brahman. A third representative school of thought in Hindu philosophy is the interpretation of the Vedas texts found in the Yoga Sutras. The yoga system takes the mind to be composed of three primary functions, manas, or perception, buddhi, or the intellect, and ahamkara, or the ego, or sense of self. Ideas are then seen as mental modifications that arise from the interaction between these faculties and external stimuli. These mental modifications, which include thoughts, emotions, and impressions, are responsible for the way we experience the world. However, these modifications are often clouded by ignorance and attachment, which distort our perception of reality and lead to suffering. The goal of yoga is to achieve mental stillness, where the fluctuations of the mind are calmed and the individual can experience Purusha, the true nature of the self, or pure consciousness, free from the distortions of ideas and mental projections. In this way, yoga sees ideas as a limiting factor in spiritual growth, the false identification of the body with the mind, inhibiting a state of union with the divine. Even if it can be argued that an idealist in the Western philosophical tradition would share some of the concerns about imperfect mental representations that underscore the theory of ideas in Hinduism, it is at least clear that in Hindu philosophy, intellectual abstraction and mental construction is viewed with negativity, standing, as it does, as a barrier to spiritual growth, self-realization, and liberation. Another Indian philosophical school of thought that approaches the theory of ideas in a similar fashion is Theravada Buddhism, one of two branches of Buddhism we shall examine in this episode. Theravada characterizes ideas as impermanent mental constructs that arise and dissolve as part of the doctrine of dependent origination, and ultimately also advocates in favor of their transcendence in order to achieve liberation from suffering. Theravada also distinguishes between nama, mind, and rupa, matter, and proceeds to argue that ideas are formed when certain mental factors, cetasikas, engage with experiences of the material. Among these mental factors are sana, perception, that which recognizes and labels experiences, allowing conceptualization, vitaka, initial application of thought, that which directs the mind toward an object, forming the basis of an idea, and vikara, sustained thought, the continued examination of an object, refining and stabilizing the idea of it. These processes are considered impermanent, unsatisfactory, and devoid of a self, making ideas in Theravada inherently dynamic and conditioned phenomena. The formation of ideas is part of the Buddhist doctrine of dependent origination, which posits reality as being part of a causal and conditional process rather than having an independent or permanent essence. This is a process of 12 linked, which is to say interdependent, causes that attempts to provide an explanation for the existence of suffering and progresses as follows. Avidya, ignorance, leads to samkara, mental formations, which leads to vinama, consciousness, which conditions nama rupa, mind and body, which results in salyatana, the 6 base senses, leading to fasa, contact, which produces vedana, feeling, causing dhamma, craving, leading to upadana, clinging, which conditions bhava, becoming, resulting in jati, birth, culminating in jara marama, aging and death. Ideas are transient products of this causal chain, seen not as ultimate realities, but rather conceptual designations that lack intrinsic existence. The only things that have intrinsic, irreducible existence in the Buddhist system are the ultimate realities, citta, consciousness, cetasika, the mental factors referred to earlier, rupa, matter, and finally nibbana, which is a mental state representing the end of suffering by bringing the 12-step cycle to an end. As a point of clarification, it should be noted that citta, cetasika, and nibbana are all types of nama, or mind. So, effectively, mind and matter are the only absolute truths in Buddhism, reality as it is, the realization of which, that is to say, the relinquishment of fixed ideas, liberates an individual from the perpetual cycle of suffering. Part 5. The Theory of Ideas in Confucianism, Taoism, and Mahayana Buddhism. We shall now turn our attention to some radically different perspectives on what is meant by an idea, starting with the Chinese philosophical system called Confucianism. This school of thought places an emphasis on the practical rather than the abstract or speculative, aiming to shape human behavior in service of promoting a harmonious society. As such, some of the most important ideas in Confucian philosophy relate more to human conduct than to human cognition. The ideas of Di, virtue, or Li, ritual, are concerned with what constitutes and cultivates a meaningful life, involving learning not only through intellectual contemplation, but also through direct engagement with others and everyday practices. The philosopher Confucius himself understood ideas as inseparable from human behavior, since they were not purely theoretical, but took root in and guided practical action. Acquiring knowledge is not merely an exercise in pure intellectual gain. Rather, it is that which leads to the cultivation of virtue and the harmonious integration of individuals into society. Therefore, in Confucianism, knowledge is understood as something more concerned with moral practice and social relationships than with abstract understanding. Where Confucian thinkers have differed from one another is with respect to whether these guiding ideas are innate to the human mind, which is to say we are born with them, or whether they must be learned through instruction, discipline, and socialization. The Confucian philosopher Mencius advocated for the former position, that innate goodness was a component of human nature and that we are born with an innate ability to distinguish between right and wrong. This innate goodness manifests itself as the 4 beginnings: compassion, ren xing, shame, qi xing, courtesy, jing xing, and the sense of right and wrong, shi fei xing, which are all considered the germinal states of virtues like ren, humaneness, Yi, righteousness, Li, ritual propriety, and Zi, wisdom. Because Mencius held that the human mind innately possessed these 4 beginnings, which were the germinal states of more fully formed ideas of virtue, every individual has the potential to be morally upright because of the seeds of the virtue existing in them already. What is required is the nourishment of these innate moral tendencies through education, reflection, and a process of self-cultivation involving the practice of rituals that align with these virtues. In contrast, the Confucian philosopher Xunzi believed that humans are inherently selfish, and that moral virtues are not innate, but must be gained, as well as cultivated, through education and ritual practice. Xunzi argues that people are born with desires and impulses that need to be controlled by education and the practice of Li, ritual. For Shunzi, knowledge and ideas are tools for transforming human nature. He emphasized the importance of education and cultural practices to shape human desires and behavior. The external education of ideas, particularly through engagement with the classics, the study of rituals, and the internalization of moral ideas, was held by Shunzi to be essential for human beings to develop the capacity to live virtuously. Confucianism adds an intriguing dimension to our exploration of the question of what an idea is. The focus of conduct rather than cognition in the Confucian analysis of ideas suggests that for some cultures the term idea may be reserved for aspects of the human experience unconnected to sensory perception or abstract understanding. The philosophical and theological tradition of Taoism is another school of thought, more interested in guiding individuals toward a practical and harmonious life rather than being engaged in attempts at understanding the true nature of reality, which the Taoist believes is beyond our ability to understand in any case. The term Tao itself means the way or the path and represents the unchanging fundamental principles that underlie all things in the universe. However, crucially, Tao is held to transcend intellectualization, to be beyond the human ability to capture in words, language, or even thought, which is to say, we cannot truly form an idea of it. All human ideas, therefore, are seen as limited and inherently flawed when compared to the ultimate reality, the Tao. For a Taoist, ideas are not seen as ultimate truths, but as conventions or tools used to navigate life and attain a direct, intuitive understanding of the world as it is. A central tenet of Taoism is that direct, non-conceptual understanding of the world is superior to intellectualized reasoning. This is captured by the idea of Wu Wei, which often translates to non-action or effortless action. Wu Wei refers to a state of spontaneous, harmonious action that arises when one is in alignment with the Tao. This idea suggests that the best way to live is not through rigid intellectual control or the application of abstract ideas, but through letting go of the need to manipulate or define the world and allowing oneself to move with the natural flow of life. For Taoists, the human mind is often seen as a barrier to spontaneous wisdom. Ideas, labels, and intellectual distinctions divide the world into categories, creating unnecessary limitations in our understanding of reality. When people rely on fixed ideas or try to impose their own ideas onto the world, they disrupt the natural flow and harmony of the Tao. Thus, Taoist philosophy encourages individuals to embrace the emptiness of mind, an openness to experience and awareness that goes beyond intellectual categorization. Taoists do not seek absolute certainty or final truths, but instead embrace the inherent uncertainty and impermanence of the world, since Taoism encourages individuals to relinquish attachments to fixed ideas and instead cultivate openness to experience. Ideas, therefore, are seen as tools for navigating life, not as ultimate representations of truth. In a thematically similar fashion, the Mahayana branch of Buddhism places extensive emphasis on the emptiness of ideas. This characterization of ideas as empty, sunyata, is slightly more firmly asserted in Mahayana than how we encountered it in Theravada, where conceptual designations were merely held to lack intrinsic existence. However, because Mahayana posits that all ideas and conceptualizations are ultimately empty, there is a particular focus on the skillful adaptation of ideas to suit different circumstances and beings, taking into account the interdependent nature of reality, that is the doctrine of dependent origination. Because to the Mahayana Buddhist, ideas dissolve upon deep examination, revealing their emptiness, ideas function pragmatically in everyday life without the need for them to be fixed or rigid. Moreover, the Mahayana denial of intrinsic existence and its especial emphasis on interdependence and emptiness leads a practitioner of this school of Buddhism to treat conceptual proliferation, which is to say categorization by way of the formulation of fixed ideas, as a primary source of suffering. Ideas thus prevent enlightenment, awakening, and a liberation from the cycles of suffering. Part 6. The Theory of Ideas in the African Ubuntu Tradition. The final philosophical tradition we will be examining in this episode is the school of thought emergent from historic, cultural, and spiritual practice native to many nations within the continent of Africa, a tradition that places centrality to the notions of collective wisdom and ancestral knowledge, all of which is captured by the foundational concept of Ubuntu. In a manner similar to the approach to the theory of ideas advocated by Confucianism and Taoism, that is, one that focuses more on the practical utility of ideas rather than the theoretical constitution of them, and sharing a similar aversion to the systematic deconstruction of what is meant by an idea as that encountered in Hinduism and Buddhism, the African philosophical tradition flowing from the concept of Ubuntu takes ideas to be fundamentally relational. The term Ubuntu is often translated to mean I am because we are, and places significant emphasis on communal existence, interdependence, and shared humanity, underscoring an understanding of society which posits that individual well-being is tied to communal well-being. Because of the centrality of interdependence at the core of the Ubuntu tradition, which is to say that the identity and value of individuals are inseparable from the well-being of the broader community, an idea in this school of thought cannot be purely intellectual or abstract. Rather, ideas are inseparable from the lived realities of individuals and communities, being grounded in shared experiences, interactions, and cultural practices. Given this relational attitude toward ideas, Ubuntu characterizes knowledge and understanding as being collectively shaped, practical, evolving, and contingent on context, serving as a tool to enhance communal life and maintain social harmony. Ideas are not only about theoretical knowledge, but are meant to guide behavior in everyday life, even woven into the fabric of everyday life, promoting peace, cooperation, and mutual respect. For this reason, within this philosophical tradition, ideas can be described as derivatives of ancestral knowledge. In many African societies, ancestral knowledge is viewed as a sacred legacy that connects the living to the past and the spiritual world. Ancestral spirits are considered not only to be guardians of the community's history, but also active participants in guiding and influencing present-day life. Thus, knowledge is seen as a living, dynamic force that guides both individual and collective behavior and is passed down orally through elders, rituals, and symbolic practices, forming a core part of the community's collective memory and wisdom. For instance, among the Akan people of West Africa, the Abuswapanin, or head of the family, is taken to embody the collective wisdom of the ancestors. This leader is seen as a channel through which the spiritual ancestors continue to impart their guidance. The communal nature of ideas thereby imparts to them some quality or characterization of collective wisdom, which is not simply the aggregation of individual ideas, but the shared insights, moral values, and practical knowledge that emerge from the community's lived experience. In this view, ideas are not developed in isolation. They are rooted in the collective experiences of the community and are aimed at fostering the health and cohesion of the community. The importance of the community in shaping ideas and the practical importance of collective wisdom is further seen in African concepts of justice and morality. In many African societies, justice is not simply about individual rights, but about restoring balance and harmony within the group. The process of conflict resolution often involves not only the parties concerned, but also the community at large. In some cases, the community, guided by collective wisdom, may mediate disputes, ensuring that the needs of all are taken into account and that social harmony is maintained. As mentioned earlier, there is no systematic exposition of a theory of ideas within the African philosophical tradition, owed in large part to the oral tradition of transmitting ancestral knowledge and collective wisdom in many African societies. These traditions include stories, myths, proverbs, songs, and rituals, all of which are vehicles for communicating important cultural values and ideas. The significance of oral traditions in African philosophy lies in the dynamic and participatory nature of knowledge transmission. Oral traditions allow for intergenerational dialogue where elders pass on knowledge to younger members of the community who in turn engage with, reinterpret, and adapt that knowledge to their own experiences. Thus, oral traditions act as a method of preserving collective memory, serving as a powerful tool for shaping identities, defining social roles, and reinforcing moral values. The Ubuntu tradition is therefore far more concerned with the practicality, adaptability, and flexibility of ideas as a class of mental objects than a formal analysis of their constitution. Unlike a more rigid, dogmatic system of thought, the Ubuntu philosophical tradition promotes a dynamic understanding of ideas, emphasizing that knowledge must always be adapted to the needs of the community for the purposes of the practical betterment of the community, such that they can continue to provide a framework for community building, conflict resolution, and social justice. This relational understanding of the theory of ideas, in which ideas are not abstract, intellectual constructs, but practical, communal, and ethical guidelines, shaped by ancestral knowledge and collective wisdom, thereby emphasizes the shared responsibility of all members of society toward achieving sustainable living, social harmony, and community resilience. Closing remarks. That brings us to the end of this first episode of the Ideology Explained series. There are many, many more thinkers and schools of thought that I could have spoken about in this episode, but I hope that the representative sample that we have explored in this episode provides a good foundation to understanding how the question, what is an idea, has been analyzed over time and across the world. You will hopefully have gained an insight into some of the varying perspectives by which an answer to that central question could be formulated. If you leave this episode wanting to know more about the theory of ideas, or curious to learn more about any of the philosophical traditions examined within the episode, then the series is off to a good start. There is little more that I could have hoped for from this first episode. There will no doubt be some listeners still quizzical about how the term idea relates to the word ideology as it appears in the title of the series. I mean it in two senses, both as the study of specific ideas in terms of a history of their usage and how they function within various schools of thought and philosophical traditions, but also as the full system of beliefs and points of view that captures an individual's understanding of the world and their place in it. As we analyze more ideas over the course of this series, hopefully we will illuminate more and more ideologies and thereby provide some insight into why disagreement arises and how we can either correct it or else accept it. I am very grateful to you for listening, and I hope you will be able to join me for the next episode. Thank you again, and take care.